The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halef. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. My dear listeners, we are at that time of year where some argue it is too hot, some argue it isn't hot enough, and others just want to find a nice quiet beach to enjoy the warmth and water and not argue at all. Needless to say, hot weather is relative, and arguing about it doesn't always seem logical. Wait, that sounds a little like philosophy. How convenient that we have stories from two co-authors who can help us sort through philosophical ideas with jokes. Today we'll hear excerpts from the book Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, written by Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, and published in 2007. Let's get started with a recap of philosophy, more specifically, the philosophy of philosophy. Metaphilosophy, the philosophy of philosophy, not to be confused with the philosophy of the philosophy of philosophy. Dimitri, I'm really getting the hang of this now, Tasso. Tasso, the hang of what? Dimitri, philosophy, of course. Tasso, you call this philosophy? The prefix meta, which basically means beyond and inclusive of all below, pops up all over the place in philosophical discourse, like in metalanguage, a language that can be used to describe language, or in metaethics, which investigates where our ethical principles come from and what they mean. So it was only a meta of time before metaphilosophy appeared on the scene. Metaphilosophy wrestles with that burning question, what is philosophy? You'd think philosophers would have known the answer to that one going in. It makes you wonder how they knew they wanted to become philosophers in the first place. We never hear about hairdressers pondering the question, what is hairdressing? If a hairdresser doesn't know what hairdressing is by now, he's in the wrong line of work. We sure as hell wouldn't want him giving our wives an updo. Nonetheless, modern philosophers are continually redefining philosophy. In the 20th century, Rudolf Carnap and the logical positivists defined away a huge hunk of philosophy when they announced that metaphysics is meaningless. They said the sole task of philosophy is to analyze scientific sentences. And Carnap's contemporary, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the godfather of ordinary language philosophy, went even further. He thought his first major book had brought the history of philosophy to a close, because he had demonstrated that all philosophical propositions were meaningless, including his own. He was so convinced that he had closed the book on philosophy that he settled down to teach elementary school. A few years later, he reopened the book of philosophy with a new conception of its purpose, therapy, of all things. By that, Ludwig meant that if we straighten out confusing language, we will cure ourselves of the blues brought on by nonsensical philosophical questions. In our own day, modal logicians, logicians who differentiate between statements that are possibly true and those that are necessarily true, worry about which category their own statements fall into. It sounds to us like meta-statements all the way down. It is in this tradition of metaphilosophy that we find Seamus. Seamus was about to go on his first date, so he asked his brother, the ladies' man, for advice. "Give me some tips on how to talk to them." "Here's the secret," said his brother. "Irish girls like to talk about three things, food, family, and philosophy. If you ask a girl what she likes to eat, it shows you're interested in her. If you ask her about her family, it shows your intentions are honorable. If you discuss philosophy, it shows you respect her intelligence." "Gee, thanks," said Seamus. "Food, family, philosophy. I can handle that." That night, as he met the young lady, Seamus blurted out, "Do you like cabbage?" "No. said the puzzled girl. "Do you have a brother?" asked Seamus. "No." "Well, if you had a brother, would he like cabbage?" That's philosophy. So, seems like philosophy can be different things to different people. The next sections may be able to help explain this. Relativity. What can we say? This term means different things to different people. Dimitri, the trouble with you, my friend, is you live too much in your head. Tasso, compared to whom? Dimitri, well, compared to Achilles, the athlete. Tasso, what about compared to Socrates? Dimitri, okay, you win again. Compared to Socrates, you're a bozo. Relative truth. Is truth relative or absolute? The ancient Taoist philosopher Xuanzu awoke from a dream in which he was a butterfly. Or, he wondered, was he really a butterfly who was now dreaming he was Xuanzu? In the modern Western world, philosophers have been obsessed by the relativity of knowledge to the knower. As we've seen, George Berkeley went so far as to say that physical objects only exist relative to the mind. In the 20th century, a Harvard professor experimented with psychedelic drugs and was fascinated by the relativity of his insights. No, we are not talking about Timothy Leary. Way before that, it was William James. When he inhaled laughing gas, James thought he saw the ultimate unity of all things. But, after the drug wore off, he couldn't remember his cosmic insights. So the story goes, the next time he sniffed laughing gas, he tied a pen to his hand and left his lab book open in front of him. Sure enough, a brilliant idea came to him, and this time he managed to get it down on paper. Hours later, in his unaltered state, he read the philosophical breakthrough he had recorded. Everything has a petroleum-like smell. Disappointed at first, Professor James soon came to his philosophical senses. The real question, he realized, was whether A, ideas that appeared brilliant to him under the influence of laughing gas were actually banal, or B, the brilliance of everything has a petroleum-like smell could not be properly appreciated unless one was under the influence of laughing gas. There's something in James's analysis that has a certain joke-like smell. Relativity of time. Lots of jokes illustrate the relativity of the perception of time. For example, a snail was mugged by two turtles. When the police asked him what happened, he said, "I don't know. It all happened so fast." And here comes that snail again. There's a knock on the door, but when the woman answers it, there's only a snail. She picks it up and throws it across the yard. 2 weeks later, there's another knock on the door. The woman answers the door, and there's the snail again. The snail says, "What was that all about?" The relativity between finite time and eternity has been a staple of philosophical thought, and so, naturally, a staple for jokesters. A man is praying to God. "Lord," he prays, "I would like to ask you a question." The Lord responds, "No problem. Go ahead." "Lord, is it true that a million years to you is but a second?" "Yes, that is true." "Well then, what is $1,000,000 to you?" $1,000,000 to me is but a penny." "Ah, then Lord," says the man, "may I have a penny?" "Sure," says the Lord, "just a second." Relativity of values. In our own day, Michel Foucault focused on another kind of relativity, the relativity of cultural values to social power. Our cultural values, particularly what we count as normal, determine and are determined by how society exercises control. Who counts as mentally ill? Who gets to determine that? What does it mean to be designated mentally ill for those who are so designated? What does it mean for those who get to control them? And who are those who get to control them? The answers to these questions change over time as the power arrangements in society shift. In one age, the priests are the controlling group. In another, the doctors. This has implications for how the so-called mentally ill get treated. The bottom line is that the values we think are timeless and absolute are really in constant historical flux relative to who has power and how it gets used. Pat.
Mike, I'm calling you from the freeway on my new cell phone.
Mike.
Be careful, Pat. They just said on the radio that there's a nut driving the wrong way on the freeway.
Pat.
One nut? Hell, there are hundreds of them.
From the standpoint of pure reason, Pat is just as right as the man on the radio. Relative to him, everyone else is going the wrong way. So why is the joke a joke instead of simply a clash of two points of view? Because of Foucault's point, which is that the state ultimately gets to decide what's the right way to go. Another concern of philosophers since Plato has been the relativity between temporal values and eternal values. And once again, a joke puts it in perspective. There once was a rich man who was near death. He was very much aggrieved because he had worked very hard for his money, and he wanted to be able to take it with him to heaven. So he began to pray that he might be able to take some of his wealth. An angel heard his plea and appeared to him. "Sorry, but you can't take your wealth with you." The man implored the angel to speak to God to see if he might bend the rules. The angel appeared and announced that God had decided to make an exception and was only allowing him to take one suitcase with him. Overjoyed, the man gathered his largest suitcase, filled it with pure gold bars, and placed it beside his bed. Soon afterward, the man died and showed up at the pearly gates. Saint Peter, seeing the suitcase, said, "Hold on, you can't bring that in here." But the man explained to Saint Peter that he had permission and asked him to verify his story with the Lord. Sure enough, Saint Peter returned, saying, "You're right. You are allowed one carry-on bag, but I'm supposed to check its contents before letting it through." Saint Peter opened the suitcase to inspect the worldly items that the man found too precious to leave behind, and exclaimed, "You brought pavement?" Absolute relativity. Much philosophical error stems from treating relative points of view as though they were absolute. Thomas Jefferson, borrowing from the British philosopher John Locke, found the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to be self-evident, presumably because he thought they were universal and absolute. But this is clearly not so self-evident to a person from another culture, say, a radical Islamist, who thinks pursuing happiness is exactly what characterizes an infidel. The opposite error is possible, too. We may attribute relativity to something that is absolute. The lookout on a battleship spies a light ahead off the starboard bow. The captain tells him to signal the other vessel. "Advise you change course 20 degrees immediately." The answer comes back. "Advise you change course 20 degrees immediately." The captain is furious. He signals, "I am a captain. We are on a collision course. Alter your course 20 degrees now." The answer comes back. "I am a seaman, second class, and I strongly urge you to alter your course 20 degrees. Now the captain is beside himself with rage. He signals, "I am a battleship." The answer comes back. "I am a lighthouse." Keep in mind these deep thoughts on relativity the next time you send out for Chinese food, or, as the Chinese call it, food. Dimitri. "So, Tasso, you seem to be one of those guys who thinks there is no absolute truth, that all truth is relative."
Tasso.
"Right."
Dimitri. "Are you sure of that?"
Tasso.
"Absolutely."
One thing about philosophy, it keeps getting more and more complex. Hopefully the next section will help simplify some things for us. The principle of parsimony.
There has always been an anti-metaphysical strain on philosophy, culminating in the triumph of the scientific worldview in the last two centuries. Rudolf Carnap and the Vienna Circle, not a 70s disco group, contrary to popular opinion, went so far as to outlaw metaphysics as non-rational speculation that has been superseded by science. Rudy and the VC took their cue from the 14th century theologian William Ockham, who came up with the principle of parsimony, a.k.a. Ockham's razor. This principle declares that theories should not be any more complex than necessary. Or, as Ockham put it metaphysically, theories should not multiply entities unnecessarily. Suppose Isaac Newton had watched the apple fall and exclaimed, "I've got it! Apples are being caught in a tug of war between gremlins pulling them up and trolls pulling them down, and the trolls are stronger." Ockham would have retorted, "Okay, Isaac, so your theory does account for all the observable facts, but get with the program. Keep it simple." Carnap would agree. One evening after dinner, a 5-year-old boy asked his father, "Where did Mommy go?" His father told him, "Mommy is at a Tupperware party." This explanation satisfied the boy, only for a moment, but then he asked, "What is a Tupperware party, Dad?" His father figured a simple explanation would be the best approach. "Well, son," he said, "at a Tupperware party, a bunch of ladies sit around and sell plastic bowls to each other." The boy burst out laughing. "Come on, Dad, what is it really?" The simple truth is that a Tupperware party really is a bunch of ladies sitting around and selling plastic bowls to each other. But the marketing folks at the Tupperware Corporation, metaphysicians that they are, would have us believe it's more complex than that. The remaining sections today enlighten us to the different types of logic that make up philosophical theories. Logic. Without logic, reason is useless. With it, you can win arguments and alienate multitudes. Illogical reasoning. Illogical reasoning is the bane of philosophers, but heaven knows it can be useful. That's probably why it's so prevalent. An Irishman walks into a Dublin bar, orders 3 pints of Guinness, and drinks them down, taking a sip from one, then a sip from the next, until they're gone. Then he orders 3 more. The bartender says, "You know, they'd be less likely to go flat if you bought them one at a time." The man says, "Yeah, I know, but I have 2 brothers, one in the States, one in Australia. When we all went our separate ways, we promised each other that we'd all drink this way, in memory of the days when we drank together. Each of these is for one of my brothers, and the 3rd is for me." The bartender is touched and says, "What a great custom." The Irishman becomes a regular in the bar and always orders the same way. One day he comes in and orders 2 pints. The other regulars notice, and a silence falls over the bar. When he comes to the bar for his 2nd round, the bartender says, "Please accept my condolences, pal." The Irishman says, "Oh, no, everyone's fine. I just joined the Mormon church, and I had to quit drinking." In other words, self-serving logic can get you served. Inductive logic. Inductive logic reasons from particular instances to general theories and is the method used to confirm scientific theories. If you observe enough apples falling from trees, you will conclude that apples always fall down instead of up or sideways. You might then form a more general hypothesis that includes other falling bodies, like pears. Thus is the progress of science. In the annals of literature, no character is as renowned for his powers of deduction as the intrepid Sherlock Holmes, but the way Holmes operates is not generally by using deductive logic at all. He really uses inductive logic. First, he carefully observes the situation. Then he generalizes from his prior experience using analogy and probability, as he does in the following story. Holmes and Watson are on a camping trip. In the middle of the night, Holmes wakes up and gives Dr. Watson a nudge. "Watson," he says, "look up in the sky and tell me what you see."
"I see millions of stars, Holmes," says Watson.
"And what do you conclude from that, Watson?"
Watson thinks for a moment.
"Well," he says, "astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is approximately 3:15. Meteorologically, I suspect that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. Theologically, I see that God is all-powerful, and we are small and insignificant. What does it tell you, Holmes?"
"Watson, you idiot! Someone has stolen our tent!"
We don't know exactly how Holmes arrived at his conclusion, but perhaps it was something like this. 1. I went to sleep in a tent, but now I can see the stars. 2. My intuitive working hypothesis, based on analogies to similar experiences I have had in the past, is that someone has stolen our tent. 3. In testing that hypothesis, let's rule out alternative hypotheses. A. Perhaps the tent is still there, but someone is projecting a picture of stars on the roof of the tent. This is unlikely, based on my past experience of human behavior and the equipment that experience tells me would have to be present in the tent and obviously isn't. B. Perhaps the tent blew away. This is unlikely, as my past experiences lead me to conclude that that amount of wind would have awakened me, though perhaps not Watson. C. Etc., etc., etc. 4. No, I think my original hypothesis is probably correct. Someone has stolen our tent. Induction. All these years we've been calling Holmes' skill by the wrong term. Falsifiability. Patient. Last night, I dreamt I had Jennifer Lopez and Angelina Jolie in bed, and the three of us made love all night. Shrink. Obviously, you have a deep-seated desire to sleep with your mother. Patient. What? Neither of those women looks remotely like my mother. Shrink. Aha! A reaction formation. You're obviously repressing your real desires. The above is not a joke. It is actually the way some Freudians reason. And the problem with their reasoning is that there is no conceivable set of actual circumstances that would disprove their Oedipal theory. In his critique of inductive logic, 20th century philosopher Karl Popper argued that in order for a theory to hold water, there must be some possible circumstances that could demonstrate it to be false. In the above pseudo-joke, there are no such circumstances that the Freudian therapist will admit as evidence. And here's a real joke that hits Popper's point even more pointedly. Two men are making breakfast. As one is buttering the toast, he says, "Did you ever notice that if you drop a piece of toast, it always lands butter side down?" The second guy says, "No, I bet it just seems that way because it's so unpleasant to clean up the mess when it lands butter side down. I bet it lands butter side up just as often." The first guy says, "Oh yeah? Watch this." He drops the toast to the floor where it lands butter side up. The second guy says, "See, I told you." The first guy says, "Oh, I see what happened. I buttered the wrong side." For this guy, no amount of evidence will falsify his theory. Logic and semantic paradoxes. The mother of all the logic and semantic paradoxes was Russell's paradox, named for its author, 20th century English professor Bertrand Russell. It goes like this. Is the set of all sets that are not members of themselves a member of itself? This one is a real screamer. That is, if you happen to have an advanced degree in mathematics. But hang on. Fortunately, two other 20th century logicians named Grelling and Nelson came along with a more accessible version of Russell's paradox. It's a semantic paradox that operates on the concept of words that refer to themselves. Here goes. There are two kinds of words, those that refer to themselves, autological, and those that don't, heterological. Some examples of autological words are short, which is a short word, polysyllabic, which has several syllables, and our favorite, 17-lettered, which has 17 letters. Examples of heterological words are knock-kneed, a word that has no knees, touching or otherwise, and monosyllabic, a word that has more than one syllable. The question is the word heterological, autological, or heterological? If it's autological, then it's heterological. If it's heterological, then it's autological. Ha ha! Still not laughing? Well, here's another case of where translating a philosophical concept into a funny story makes it clearer. There is a town in which a sole barber, a man, by the way, shaves all the townsmen and only those townsmen who do not shave themselves. Does the barber shave himself? If he does, he doesn't. If he doesn't, he does. Now that's Russell's paradox for the party set. We don't often visit women's restrooms, so we can't be sure what goes on in there, but we do know that male readers will be familiar with the paradoxes often scribbled on the walls of men's room stalls, especially in college communities. They are logical/semantic paradoxes along the lines of Russell's and Grelling Nelson's, but snappier. Remember these? Remember where you were sitting at the time? True or false? This sentence is false. Or, if a man tries to fail and succeeds, which did he do? Just for fun, inscribe, is the word heterological, autological, or heterological over the urinal next time you drop by? It's a classy thing to do. Dimitri, cute, but what does any of this have to do with answering the big questions? Tasso, well, let's say you visit the oracle at Delphi and ask him, what is it all about, Delphi? And he answers, life is a picnic. All picnics are fun. Therefore, life is fun. Logic gives you something to think about. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halaf. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's Halaf is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.